There's an old dark joke about people serving time in prison. There's a scene about it in the movie The Shawshank Redemption. At a cafeteria table filled with long incarcerated prisoners, a wide-eyed young convict asked Andy Dufresne what crime brought him to the state of Maine's fictional Shawshank State Prison. Dufresne doesn't exactly answer the question. "Everybody's innocent in here," he says. "Don't you know that?" The old timers at the cafeteria table giggle at first. Then they burst into laughter. Implicit in the joke is that the legal system works and that the concept of a wrongful conviction is a little silly. Of course, wrongful convictions aren't silly. In the 30 years since Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld established the Innocence Project in New York, law students and established lawyers, and even novelists like John Grisham, have worked to discover people who are actually innocent of crimes that landed them behind bars, and then get them out of prison. To date, Innocence Project chapters across the United States have helped to exonerate 281 people through DNA analysis alone. And a recent report from the National Registry of Exonerations says that's just a drop in the bucket. The registry identified 3,248 known exonerations in the United States since 1989. Today, we're looking at the case of Sedley Alley. Is it the case of another wrongful conviction, this one leading to even more serious implications? Convicted in 1985 of a brutal rape and murder that occurred just outside Memphis, Tennessee, Sedley Alley always maintained his innocence. When DNA testing became more common in the 1990s and early 2000s, he petitioned the Innocence Project to look into his case. They did, and they found evidence that could have been tested to either definitively prove his guilt or support his innocence claims. After years of legal wrangling, a Tennessee court eventually decided that Sedley wouldn't be allowed to test any of the evidence Innocence Project investigators found. In today's episode, which is somewhat of a special edition of Court Junkie, we're talking with Daniel Medwed, author of the new book, Barred: Why the Innocent Can't Get Out of Prison. I read it, was absolutely fascinated by what I learned, and I thought it would make for a great episode. We'll discuss how and why Sedley Alley's case went the way it did, and what it means for the legal system as a whole. This is Jillian, and in partnership with Law and Crime, you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 224. It's hard to stick with working out. I know that after I had my daughter, it was super difficult to continue to be motivated to get up early every morning and get a workout in. But Peloton made it a lot easier. They have on-demand classes, so you can sneak in a workout whenever you want, for however long you want it to be. And their instructors are incredibly motivating and make the workout fun. It got to the point where I looked forward to hopping on my bike in the mornings. You likely already know that Peloton makes bikes, but did you know they also make treadmills? And not just any treadmills. The Peloton Tread can adjust your speed and incline automatically. And Peloton Tread instructors have a variety of training backgrounds and styles of motivation for runners and walkers of all levels. You don't have to be a super athlete to enjoy Peloton. Try Peloton Tread risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only, not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial. Court Junkie is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Let's face it, sometimes multitasking can be overwhelming. Like when your favorite podcast is playing and the person next to you is talking and your car fan is blasting, all while you're trying to find the perfect parking spot. But then again, sometimes multitasking is easy, like quoting with Progressive Insurance. They do the hard work of comparing rates so you can find a great rate that works for you, even if it's not with them. Give their nifty comparison tool a try, and you might just find getting the rate and coverage you deserve is easy. All you need to do is visit Progressive's website to get a quote with all the coverages you want, like comprehensive and collision coverage or personal injury protection. Then you'll see Progressive's direct rate, and their tool will provide options from other companies all lined up and ready to compare. So it's simple to choose the rate and coverages you like. Press play on comparing auto rates. Quote at progressive.com to join the over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. If you're a longtime Court Junkie listener, you might recognize Daniel Medved from the episode about the Michelle Carter case from a few years back.
This is Daniel Medved. I'm University Distinguished Professor of Law and Criminal Justice, a fancy title that my parents loved, at Northeastern University in Boston.
In his new book, Barred, Why the Innocent Can't Get Out of Prison, Daniel discusses a litany of cases that trouble him. But the case of Sedley Alley sticks in his mind more than most. Sedley's case began in 1985, outside a military base on the outskirts of Memphis, Tennessee.
A Marine corporal named Suzanne Collins was apparently jogging when she was sexually assaulted and murdered in a park near the base. Sedley Alley became a suspect based on some descriptions given by two Marines who had seen Collins driving. And long story short, he gave a confession, which he later claimed was coerced, about the crime.
False confessions are common in wrongful convictions. According to Innocence Project data, as many as 25% of all wrongful convictions begin with a coerced or otherwise untrue admission of guilt. Daniel says Sedley's case is similar, and that investigators in Sedley's case should have known that his confession was questionable.
There are many discrepancies between the details of his confession and the actual facts of the crime, which is one reason among many why a lot of advocates, including Barry Scheck and others at the Innocence Project in New York, believe that Alley was innocent.
About that confession, according to court documents, Sedley had epilepsy, brain injuries from earlier trauma, and other mental illnesses. Despite this, investigators interrogated him for more than 4 hours before Sedley confessed to killing Suzanne Collins. After that alleged confession, investigators said Sedley's formal statement lasted nearly 2 hours. But an audio recording of that formal statement is only 53 minutes long. It contains a half dozen moments in which investigators appear to stop the recording before starting up again. What's more, Daniel says,
gist of the confession, the real details in the confession, did not mesh with the facts of the crime. Okay, so for instance, he claimed that he had struck Collins with his car at a particular spot in the park and used a screwdriver to stab her. But the location he mentioned wasn't the one cited by those two Marine witnesses, and the autopsy gave no indication that Collins had been stabbed or hit with a vehicle.
In fact, an autopsy showed that she had been struck at least 100 times and then strangled. She had been sexually assaulted and impaled with a tree branch. Daniel cites another example.
In addition, none of Collins's blood, hair, or fingerprints were found on Alley. There were slight streaks of blood on the driver's side door of his wagon. They came back as type O blood, which is very common, and it was the same as both Alley and Collins. There also were discrepancies in tire tracks and shoe prints that were identified at the crime scene.
According to the Innocence Project, the tire tracks found at the scene were not from Sedley's vehicle, and the shoe prints were inconsistent with his shoes. But Daniel focuses on one more discrepancy, one that he says should have stopped investigators in their tracks.
Most notably, there was another witness, a third witness, who saw someone with a station wagon near the site of Collins's murder, and that person described a much shorter man. Sedley Alley was about 6'4" and sported a long red mane. He was a very distinctive person, but this third eyewitness described a man who was about 5'6" to 5'8" and with short brown hair.
It appears the confession really didn't match up with some of the key attributes of the actual crime. And what causes Daniel concern in Sedley's case, and in many others, is that these discrepancies were known a long time prior to Sedley going to trial. He calls it a phenomenon known as confirmation bias. Once you develop a theory, you develop tunnel vision, and you tend to view all contrary evidence through the lens of that expectation.
This is borne out in a lot of studies, like taste tests. If you're a Budweiser drinker and you do blind taste tests and it turns out you prefer another kind of beer, you still might insist to your dying day that Budweiser is the best beer. So my hunch is that Sedley Alley really met the initial description based on that station wagon. He had been drinking. He was a rather unusual person. He confessed to the crime, albeit after many hours of interrogation. And at that point, I suspect that the police just latched onto this theory and could then sort of reconcile the facts that didn't fit in as not very significant facts.
It worked for investigators and prosecutors at the time. And Sedley didn't seem to have the best legal representation or strategy. An article about Sedley's trial from the Memphis Commercial Appeal in March 1987 says that Sedley told a psychiatrist that, quote, a figure called Death, wearing a black cape and hood and riding a white horse, was with him on the night he raped and killed Marine Lance Corporal Susan M. Collins. So Sedley and his attorneys didn't dispute his confession in 1987, despite its discrepancies with the factual record. Instead, they offered a jury an admission of major psychiatric issues, hallucinations, possible multiple personality disorder. Indeed, that's how Sedley and his lawyers ultimately defended him at his initial trial. They claimed that he wasn't responsible for murdering Suzanne Collins, because he had multiple personalities. That defense didn't work. On March 18, 1987, a jury found Sedley guilty of first-degree murder. A judge later sentenced him to death. You may have heard the saying that it's easier to put someone in prison than it is to get them out. Well, a conviction tends to bring a case to a halt, no matter how ineffective a defendant's counsel might have seemed or what evidence of innocence might exist. Daniel says this is due to the nature of how the criminal justice system works in the United States.
And sort of long story short, it's that the system does value finality and efficiency over accuracy. And the presumption of innocence, which is a value we hold near and dear to our heart, at the front end of the process, disappears after there's a conviction, and it's replaced by a presumption of guilt, which becomes almost immovable, even when you've accumulated powerful evidence of innocence.
And so, for nearly two decades, Sedley Alley's case stalled. Multiple appeals failed. The Tennessee Supreme Court affirmed his convictions and sentence on direct appeal in 1989. The United States Supreme Court declined to hear the case in 1990. The Tennessee Court of Appeals upheld his convictions and sentence in 1997. Sedley filed a petition for writ of habeas corpus in 1998, a standard last-ditch process by which a convicted defendant can appeal to a federal district court under the grounds that their detention is unlawful, that their body, their corpus, is being held in captivity without reasonable cause. The District Court for the West District of Tennessee dismissed Sedley's habeas corpus petition in 2000. The Sixth Circuit affirmed that decision in 2002. The U.S. Supreme Court again declined to hear the case in 2003. On December 9, 2003, the state of Tennessee filed a motion requesting an execution date. They got one. Sedley would be executed on June 3rd, 2004. It seemed like the end of the road for Sedley Alley. But as Daniel Medwet explains, that's when the Innocence Project got involved.
The Innocence Project petitioned the Tennessee Board of Pardon and Parole to delay Allie's looming execution to conduct DNA tests on various items of evidence.
As it turned out, there was a lot of evidence that could be tested using DNA technology.
So there was lots of evidence at the crime scene, including some underwear, a tree branch that had been used to violate the victim, lots of blood evidence, as I indicated as well. And the Innocence Project wanted to do something quite simple: test that evidence and then develop a genetic profile of whom it belonged to, and then run that evidence through something called the CODIS database, which is the Combined DNA Index System. The CODIS database is maintained by the FBI at the federal level.
The Innocence Project's mission in Sedley's case wasn't complicated.
And so basically, the Innocence Project said, look, there's credible reason to believe that Sedley Alley didn't commit this crime. Let's just test the evidence and match it up.
While that request may have seemed simple, it wasn't.
Even though Tennessee had a post-conviction DNA testing law, it had been established in 2001, that gave access to this type of request, the Court of Criminal Appeals in Tennessee interpreted that statute very, very narrowly and said that Sedley Alley didn't have a basis for getting testing here. So the Court of Criminal Appeals denied the Innocence Project's request to test this evidence.
The opinion used a surprising justification to deny the DNA testing.
The rationale for this opinion in 2006 is that basically this statute wasn't concerned about identifying an alternative perpetrator, that wasn't the purpose of the DNA Testing Act, that really the DNA Testing Act was going to be used to prove your innocence directly. And the court ruled that because there was overwhelming evidence against Sedley Alley anyway, this testing couldn't prove his innocence. It was kind of a convoluted argument.
The opinion was, in other words, a very narrow interpretation of Tennessee's DNA testing law. It was that the law was only in existence to exclude a criminal defendant as the suspect. In Sedley's case, according to the court's opinion, excluding Sedley as a defendant wouldn't be useful anyway, because he had confessed to the crime. Daniel did not agree with the opinion.
Because the court said there was all this other evidence pointing to Alley, it wasn't an appropriate use of this statute, if that makes sense.
As a result of this opinion, Sedley's case did finally come to a close. It didn't merely seem like the end of the road for Sedley at this point. It was the end of the road. The state of Tennessee executed Sedley Alley by lethal injection on June 28, 2006. Barry Scheck, who co-founded the Innocence Project and led Sedley's recent appeals, told the Tennessean newspaper that the state's unwillingness to test DNA in Sedley's case was deeply disturbing. DNA reveals the truth, he said. It can exonerate the innocent and identify the guilty. But in this case, DNA couldn't reveal the truth because nobody would let the evidence be tested. Scheck went on. Tonight, the state of Tennessee executed a man they thought was probably guilty. That shouldn't be good enough. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Everyone can feel bogged down sometimes, especially at the start of a new year and after the holidays. We've all heard the phrase, new year, new you, but what if you're just not feeling it? Working with a therapist can help you get closer to the best version of you. Because when you feel empowered, you're more prepared to take on everything life throws at you. Therapy isn't just for someone who has experienced major trauma. I started seeing a therapist back in my 20s when I was going through a divorce. It helped me get through it in a positive way, where I was able to move forward with my life, and I couldn't be more grateful. So if you're thinking of giving therapy a try, BetterHelp is a great option. It's convenient, flexible, affordable, and entirely online. All you do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. You can also switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. If you want to live a more empowered life, therapy can get you there. Visit BetterHelp.com/court today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/court. According to the EPA, indoor air on average can be 2 to 5 times more polluted than outdoor air. And sometimes it can be up to 100 times more polluted than outdoor air. That's right, 100 times more polluted. And you can find that statistic right on the EPA website. So what's the solution? We're happy to introduce an air purifier that captured the attention of established media outlets like CNN, Money, ABC, and more. Air Doctor filters out dangerous contaminants and allergens, so your lungs don't have to. Air Doctor uses an ultra HEPA filter that's been independently tested to remove 99.99% of tested bacteria and viruses. Allergens can vary in size, but the average pollen size is about 25 microns. Air Doctor captures particles as small as 0.003 microns in size. That's 100 times smaller than even the HEPA standard. Air Doctor also captures a wide range of pollutants, including odors, gases, and chemicals like formaldehyde. From stinky gym clothes to chemical cleaning products, Air Doctor is always on call to keep your air fresh and clean. Their classic Air Doctor 3000 purifier is powerful enough to circulate the air in a 630-plus square foot room 4 times per hour. And there's no need to worry about noise. They use their exclusive professional whisper jet fans that are 30% quieter than the fans found in ordinary air purifiers. And their new Air Doctor 2000 is the first affordable purifier that not only removes virtually 100% of airborne particles, but also the vast majority of toxic ozone, volatile organic compounds, and gas in indoor environments. Essentially, it's a smaller, but still very powerful Air Doctor. Air Doctor comes with a no-questions-asked 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you don't love it, just send it back for a refund minus shipping. So head on over to airdoctorpro.com and use the promo code QUART. And depending on the model, you'll receive up to 35% off. You're saving up to 35% off. Lock this special offer by going to airdoctorpro.com, airdoctorpro.com, and use the promo code QUART. It's worth recapping the highlights of Sedley Ali's case so far. After a jury convicted him of raping and killing Marine Lance Corporal Suzanne Collins near Memphis, Tennessee, Sedley maintained his innocence. His appeals failed for years, all the way to the highest court in the United States. When DNA testing became more common, the Innocence Project petitioned a Tennessee court to test the evidence in his case, just to make sure that DNA evidence didn't point to someone else as Collins' killer. That petition failed. The court wouldn't allow it. And so the state of Tennessee executed Sedley in 2006, 2 decades after a jury found him guilty of first-degree murder. Sedley's case is unique because it may represent one of the very few cases in which a government entity in the United States has executed an innocent man. But according to Daniel Medwed, Sedley's case isn't all that unusual.
About 33 years after the first DNA exoneration in the United States, we have a pretty good sense of what goes wrong in these cases. Eyewitnesses make mistakes. People falsely confess to crimes, as some observers think happened in the Sedley Ali case. Police and prosecutors commit misconduct. Forensic analysts present junk science. And defense lawyers are sometimes in over their heads, and they engage in ineffective assistance of counsel. But what's less well known, and which is really the subject of Bard, is why it takes so long on the back end to overturn cases even after you've compiled ample evidence of innocence.
This may seem obvious, but the best time to assess false confessions, potential police misconduct, and all of the other issues that can lead to wrongful convictions is during the initial trial. When a person is facing charges, they're presumed innocent, But after a jury convicts them, that's no longer true. They're presumed guilty. So what's a wrongfully convicted person to do? Daniel describes the options. The first is the direct appeal.
Every state, all 50 states, by statute, by legislative enactment, have given criminal defendants the right to appeal there. But there are certain procedural limitations. So first, when you are appealing your conviction, it's called the direct appeal. It's a vertical remedy, which means you're limited to exactly what happened at trial. You can't bring in new evidence. And what's more, you usually can only raise issues that were directly presented to the trial judge.
There are various rationales for this, Daniel says. Namely,
the primacy of the trial in resolving issues and the idea that you want trial judges to have the first opportunity to get it right. And you want to incentivize litigants to present these issues to trial courts.
Direct appeals are often not effective because of that.
There are also really deferential standards of review on appeal that basically require appellate judges to defer to decisions by trial judges, by defense attorneys in terms of strategy, and by juries in reaching their decision.
Aside from the direct appeal, there are two basic post-conviction remedies that are available. One is the writ of habeas corpus, which, unlike a direct appeal, is actually mentioned in the Constitution.
And habeas corpus allows you to go to the government and ask it to justify why, quote, they have the body in detention. And you can use habeas corpus to either contest pretrial detention, that happened in the famous Guantanamo Bay cases, or post-conviction detention, where, for instance, a state trial or a state direct appeal have proven inadequate to overturning a conviction.
Daniel stresses how important and powerful the federal right to habeas corpus can be. It allows you to go to a federal judge and ask that judge to take a new look. But there's a problem with habeas corpus, according to Daniel.
But here's the glitch. Even though in theory, habeas corpus has been called the great writ, and for centuries, it's been lauded as this way to correct injustices, in practice, it's a really poor tool for fixing wrongful convictions. Because as a matter of habeas corpus jurisprudence, judges can only look at claims of constitutional error or jurisdictional error, not typically claims of actual innocence.
So the judge can only look at errors that may have occurred, not whether the convict may actually be innocent. In his book, Daniel writes about the 1993 U.S. Supreme Court decision in Herrera v. Collins,
which says that that federal judges in a habeas corpus action may not consider a freestanding or bare actual innocence claim. That if a litigant has an actual innocence claim, it has some dual consequences in terms of reviving old constitutional claims for review. But by itself, the actual innocence claim isn't what's called cognizable, reviewable by a federal habeas corpus judge.
In other words, even if someone like Sedley Alley has a very credible claim of innocence in their habeas corpus petition, that doesn't necessarily mean that they should be granted relief under the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishments.
The rationale here, Jillian, is that the trial is when guilt or innocence should really be vetted, and we don't want a federal judge sort of second-guessing state court trial decisions years later. And also another rationale, which Chief Justice Rehnquist cited in that notorious Herrera decision, is that executive clemency is out there. The power of a governor to grant a pardon or a commutation to an innocent prisoner, that's the appropriate remedy for possible wrongful convictions. So that's the problem with habeas corpus.
In summary, defendants who want to appeal their possible wrongful convictions can pursue a direct appeal, or they can file a habeas corpus petition. And Daniel describes a third option.
The other remedy that's often available is grounded in a different writ. It's called the writ of error coram nobis. And coram nobis means before us. And it allows a prisoner to go back to the original trial judge with newly discovered evidence that suggests that the original conviction was mistaken, that it lacks integrity. And you ask that original trial judge for a new trial.
This third option appears to offer a solution to the problems with direct appeals and habeas corpus petitions. But Daniel says there are two main problems with this option.
The first problem is that courts are often really stingy in defining what's newly discovered evidence. If the evidence could have been found at the time of trial, then it won't be considered newly discovered. Second, these motions typically go, as I indicated, to the original trial judge. And that original trial judge might be vested sort of emotionally and psychologically in the original trial outcome, and they might discount the power of this new evidence.
Going back to that first problem for a second, where Daniel said that if the new evidence they're presenting could have been found at the time of the trial, then it won't be considered newly discovered evidence. In his book, Daniel gives the example of Bobby Fennell, who spent 16 years in prison for murder, a crime he says he didn't commit. At the time, Daniel and his team at Brooklyn Law School's Second Look program reinvestigated the case. They corroborated Bobby's alibi. He was with his girlfriend at the time. He passed a lie detector test. And even more significant, another man ultimately confessed after Bobby's trial to being the sole perpetrator. But the evidence wasn't new in the sense that it could have been discovered at the time of trial. As Daniel writes, the polygraph was of limited value in the courtroom. The man who had confessed after the trial had testified at trial, not that he was the sole perpetrator, of course, but testified nonetheless. And Bobby's girlfriend was available back then to question. Bobby's trial counsel had just made the decision not to call her to the stand. And so there was no path to getting Bobby Fennell out. Daniel recalls going to the prison and having to let Bobby know the bad news. Now, once these three options are exhausted, direct appeal, writ of habeas corpus, and writ of coram nobis, an appeal can be made to executive authorities like governors for clemency, parole, pardons, and commutations. But these options also have flaws.
And the problem is basically this. These executive remedies are grounded in forgiveness. They're grounded in mercy. They're grounded in grace. And they're often predicated on the idea that a prisoner has to admit guilt, display remorse, and accept responsibility as a predicate to getting this type of state-sanctioned benevolence.
This can create a dilemma for a person who didn't commit the crime that put them behind bars.
A person who's wrongfully convicted, who didn't actually do the crime they're in prison for, how are they going to accept responsibility for it? How are they going to admit guilt? So these are sort of ill-fitting remedies for the factually innocent person. They're good remedies for someone who admits they did something wrong and has been rehabilitated and reformed over the course of their incarceration, but not for someone who's actually innocent.
In popular culture, often in true crime television shows like Law & Order and CSI, a remedy used most often for the wrongfully convicted is DNA analysis. DNA tends to solve all problems, proving innocence and exposing guilt beyond all reasonable doubt. But Daniel explains that DNA analysis is often not even an option. Biological evidence isn't often available at a crime scene for your average robbery or theft or even a shooting. There's no hand-to-hand combat that could lead to the perpetrator leaving biological evidence at the crime scene. DNA evidence is normally available in specific kinds of cases, sexual or physical assault, or murders.
Experts estimate that biological evidence is only available in about 10 to 20% of criminal cases to begin with. And then, even if it's available at the outset, it might get lost or never be found by crime scene investigators.
And the cases in which DNA testing can help to identify someone are often very old.
In addition, given the advancement of DNA technology, and it's become more ubiquitous as the years have passed, what happens now, and has really happened since the late 1980s, Jillian, is that police and prosecutors will test any biological evidence that's found at the crime scene at the front end. They'll test it. And that means that we'll be able to weed out innocent suspects and implicate guilty suspects then. So most of the cases now where you can use DNA technology to exonerate someone are old cases from the 70s or 80s where the biological evidence still exists, but it was never tested.
So going back to Sedley Alley's case, it was obviously too late to try and prove his innocence in order to get him released from jail. But members of his family still wanted to try. They wanted to clear his name, even after he was executed, even after all their options seemed to have been exhausted. The state of Tennessee executed Sedley Alley in 2006. The Court of Criminal Appeals in Tennessee paved the way for that execution after it interpreted Tennessee's post-conviction DNA testing law to mean that courts could test DNA to prove innocence, but not to identify an alternative perpetrator. As fate would have it, 5 years later, on June 28, 2011, the Tennessee Supreme Court developed a new interpretation of Tennessee's DNA testing statute. The Tennessee Supreme Court found that
the purpose of this law is not just to exonerate someone, a criminal defendant, but it's also to potentially identify the true suspect. Therefore, had this interpretation, this 2011 interpretation of the law, been in effect in 2006 before Sedley Alley had been executed, Adley would have been entitled to DNA testing.
Sedley Alley wasn't going to file any petitions from beyond the grave. But Sedley, who was only 29 years old when prosecutors accused him of murder, left behind family. Two children, to be specific. A son and a daughter. Sedley's daughter, April Alley, was only 9 years old when police arrested her dad in 1985. Years after the new interpretation of the state's DNA testing statute, in 2019, April decided to try to prove his innocence posthumously. She told the New York Times that Sedley had been an alcoholic and a drug addict when police arrested him, and that he didn't recall committing the crime. April said that Sedley told her, "If I did do it, I deserve what I get, but I don't remember doing it."
So she decided to become the personal representative of his estate. She petitioned to become the personal representative, which meant that she basically inherited a lot of his rights under trust and estate law in Tennessee. And arguably, she inherited his right to petition for DNA testing in his case. So the Innocence Project worked with April Alley in 2019 to file a new petition. And the petition basically said, based on this new interpretation of the Tennessee DNA testing law, this 2011 interpretation, we should be entitled to test the remaining biological evidence in the case, the underwear, the tree branch, the blood.
It might seem like April had a good argument to make here. The law that disallowed her father from testing evidence in his own case had now changed. And after filing a petition on April's behalf, Innocence Project lawyers argued in front of the Tennessee Court of Criminal Appeals about Sedley's case. They argued that his estate should now be allowed to test evidence using DNA analysis. Here's Paul Clement, former U.S. Solicitor General under President George W. Bush, arguing on behalf of April and Sedley on February 3, 2021. He's discussing a question from a judge on the Criminal Appeals Court about why the court should even hear April's petition. When Paul discusses powers here, That's a reference to the 2011 case that reinterpreted Tennessee's DNA testing law.
But if you accept the premise that if Mr. Alley were alive, he would be able to get access to the evidence, then it seems to me that there is a powerful case based on the text of the statute, the legislative purposes as identified in Powers, and constitutional avoidance principles, that same right just passes to the estate, and the estate can prosecute the action essentially on Mr. Alley's behalf.
Notice what Clement argues there. The questions from the appeals court judges aren't about the merits of April's petition or the integrity of the evidence available for testing. Their questions are about whether Sedley's estate even had the right to file a petition on Sedley's behalf after his death. Here's Paul Clement again.
I think even though he's no longer living, Mr. Alley is still a person convicted of first-degree murder, and he's entitled to file the petition at any time. It's something of a procedural detail, I think, that the action's being filed by the estate rather than the individual. But of course, that's what Tennessee law provides, that when somebody has essentially a right of action, but are no longer living, then under the survivorship statute and the rest, the way you continue to prosecute that action is bringing the action in the name of the estate.
One of the appeals court judges, Judge Ross Dyer, wasn't so sure.
The criminal code for sure does not define a person as an estate or anything other than a person, as you and I would think about it under the Webster's definition of a person, a living being. And even if you want to bring in the civil code, when it talks about an estate's rights, it doesn't contemplate something like this in any way.
It wasn't a surprise then that April Alley's petition didn't go as she had hoped.
The Court of Criminal Appeals in 2021 refused to look at the merits of the claim. Instead, they bounced the claim on a very technical ground. The court held that the DNA testing statute in Tennessee refers to the right of a, quote, person to request DNA testing. And because April Alley was just a personal representative of Sedley Alley, she technically didn't count as a person for purposes of this litigation, and therefore didn't have what's known as standing, the right to file this claim.
This decision floored Daniel.
A pretty shocking decision that elevated the value of procedure over substance, that elevated finality, the goal of finishing up these cases, over the goal of accuracy.
And that decision brought April Alley's petition to a full stop.
So right now, that's essentially where things stand. And to this day, those items have not yet been subjected to post-conviction DNA testing.
Although Daniel was shocked by the decision, at the same time, he understood why it occurred.
You know, when you think about it from the state's perspective, on the one hand, there's the notion, sort of the moral notion, of doing the right thing, of trying to determine whether guilt or innocence can be proven. Has Tennessee executed an innocent person? But on the other hand, you consider the political and practical variables at play. You know, Alley is dead. It's not as though hearing his name at this late date will actually bring him back to life. And also, of course, there's more of a sort of metaphysical fear that if, in fact, the testing here were to exonerate Alley, it would cast aspersions on the application of the death penalty in Tennessee. And so you could imagine that the governor and the courts might not have a strong interest in potentially undermining the integrity or the perception of capital punishment there. But it really is flabbergasting and saddening.
And so Sedley Alley's case represents how difficult it can be to prove if someone is truly innocent in the United States after they've been convicted of a crime. But Daniel's book, Barred: Why the Innocent Can't Get Out of Prison, is filled with plenty of other similar cases. We asked him to summarize some of the key takeaways from his experiences as a lawyer, an author, and an advocate for the wrongfully convicted. He emphasized three points about those who are wrongfully convicted.
The first is that, contrary to popular opinion, prisoners don't rely on technicalities to get out. There aren't all these escape hatches from the prison cell. Contrast technicalities, procedural barriers in the appellate and post-conviction and clemency and parole processes are often what keep prisoners, even actually innocent prisoners, behind bars. So that's the first takeaway. It's sort of counterintuitive and contrary to popular belief. The second takeaway is that we can do something about this, that we can change the procedure on a micro level, and we can engage in certain macro level reforms to enhance justice. So, for instance, one proposal I make is that each state could create its own freestanding innocence commission that's vested with the power and has the funding to investigate credible claims of innocence and refer the most meritorious of them to the courts.
The final takeaway, Daniel said, is an appeal to empathy for those who are behind bars for crimes they did not commit.
That the people behind prison bars are really you and me. In so much of the conversation about criminal justice, there's what I like to call othering. People treat folks behind bars as other, as somewhat different. And in this book, I really take pains to try to humanize them, to give them names, to tell their stories. They could be our brothers, our sisters, our spouses, our mothers, our fathers, our children. And they, just like us, as I describe in the book, they cherish the taste of lobster. They, during the COVID pandemic, they welcomed opportunities to connect with people through Zoom. They are us, and we need to understand that they deserve a full, painstaking review process of their cases where evidence suggests that they're behind bars for something they didn't commit.
And that's all for this episode. If you're curious about other people who may have been executed for crimes they didn't commit, we'll provide a link in the show notes to an article from the Death Penalty Information Center naming a few more. This episode was researched by Nicole Gusmerati and Matt Stroud, and written by Matt Stroud, who interviewed Daniel Medwed for the show. Please consider subscribing to Court Junkie if you haven't already, and if you haven't heard of our new podcast, Civil, covering cases and trials outside the criminal justice system, please check out and subscribe. Search for Civil and Court Junkie wherever you listen to podcasts. And lastly, I just want to give a little shout out to the Women in Crime podcast. Amy Schlossberg and Megan Sachs are both criminologists who have spent their entire careers studying and teaching about crime. They cover cases involving females as offenders and as victims. They also highlight the heroines of our justice system and interview people close to famous cases, including Kim Goldman, Denise Huskins, and Amanda Knox. I've worked with Megan and Amy before. We did a live together a few years back about the Jodi Arias case, and they are professional, respectful, and extremely fascinating to listen to. So that's Women in Crime anywhere you listen to podcasts. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.
All month long on Pluto TV, stream the biggest Tyler Perry movies free. Watch your favorites like Madea's Witness Protection and Madea's Big Happy Family. Join Tyler Perry as he goes on a couples retreat with Sharon Leal in Why Did I Get Married? Or Idris Elba and Gabrielle Union in the Tyler Perry-directed film Daddy's Little Girls. Plus, Pluto TV has hundreds of channels with thousands more movies and TV shows available on live and on demand. Download the free Pluto TV app on all your favorite devices and start streaming now. Pluto TV. Drop in. Watch free.